On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
We are delighted to welcome back to On the Bookshelf, Bodie Hodge. We haven't talked in quite a while, and that's my fault. So I'm really thrilled that we're having a chance to talk today. Bodie is the author of many books. His most recent is Dragon, Legends and Lore of Dinosaurs, edited and compiled by Bodie Hodge and Laura Welch, illustrated by Bill Looney. It's from Master Books, a division of New Leaf Publishing Group. You can check their website, masterbooks.com, and it's also part of the Master Books curriculum for homeschoolers and just people who want to have some very cool books to supplement the information that people get from their regular curriculum. We're really glad, Bodie, that you had time to talk to us today.
Hey, it's great to be back on the show.
You've got a very interesting background, and I know we don't want to go into enormous details, but suffice it to say that you've got degrees in mechanical engineering. You had a grant while you're working on your master's degree from Lockheed Martin to develop a new method of production of submicron titanium dibromide. I don't even know what that is.
It's a mouthful.
Yeah.
It's one of those advanced ceramics, and it's essential for nanotechnology and a lot of the space shuttle kind of thing. So it really is an amazing material.
You worked at SIUC, and then you went as a test engineer for Aerotech Engineering to work for Caterpillar, Inc. And while doing that, you were teaching apologetics to junior high and high school students. Then you took a position with Answers in Genesis in 2003. And that's, I think we've been talking since then and had the chance to talk about a couple of different books that you've written or been involved with. This new book is a really very interesting and beautiful book, very exciting visuals in it, and it talks about dragons and the possibility of dragons being real creatures and the possibility, are they related to dinosaurs? So you managed to bring all that into a very entertaining and visually exciting book. So how did you get interested in working on this particular topic?
Well, in the Ministry of Answers in Genesis, for those out there listening, that's the Ark Encounter and the Creation Museum. We deal with a lot of science subjects. We deal with a lot of history subjects. And those are the fields. Those are the kind of things that I really enjoy. And one of the things that I've really dove into over the years is dealing with dinosaurs. And so when you deal with dinosaurs, you look at a lot of that history. You look at, the word itself, dinosaur, wasn't even invented until 1841.
Right.
What would dinosaurs have been called before that? Well, the obvious answer is dragon. And a lot of Bibles use the word dragon, particularly there in the Old Testament when talking about real creatures. And we're in a culture where people say, well, dragons aren't real, so how about we get to the bottom of this? And so that's one of the reasons this book came about.
Let's talk about how old dragons, there are mentions of fantastic creatures in the Bible. That is to say, really large creatures. Leviathan is one of them, behemoth. What makes it so hard for people to believe that there were once something that were called dragons? Is it just because we don't see them around anymore?
Yeah, I think that's the primary reason. If you actually look at dragon accounts and some of these encounters that people had with dragons, I mean, they go back to ancient times. I mean, we see it on just about every continent. Well, not Antarctica.
Right.
But we see, all these different accounts. We see it from scientists. We see it from theologians. We see it from historians. Bible commentators and pastors and so forth, people talked about them as though they were real creatures living right there in their area. However, something unique started to happen. From about the 1500s to the 1800s, those number of encounters significantly declined, and they got less and less. And in the 1800s, there's only a handful of these dragon type of encounters. And so what was really going on is they were dying out, just like hosts of other animals have died out. The dodo birds have died out. Passenger pigeons have died out. A lot of people think the West African rhino has gone extinct. Same sort of thing was happening here with these dinosaur dragon-like creatures. And so people started entertaining in the 1800s, particularly on the secular side, that dragons were simply myth because we don't see them anymore. And a lot of Christians started to buy into that, and then all of a sudden that caused a problem because they're like, uh-oh, dragons are mentioned in the Bible, what do we do? And a lot of people have actually yanked the word dragon out of some of the modern translations. And yet it is the Hebrew and Greek words for dragon that are used in there.
There is a certain element that of some fantastical things that occur in the accounts of dragons. Generally, in secular sources or secular resources, the history of, the tale of George and the dragon and so forth. And that might be one reason that people have been hesitant to think of dragons as being just another word for dinosaur.
Yeah, the word dragon, if I can just kind of define it just a little bit more,
yeah.
Dragon is more of an overarching term. It's not like a specific creature. It's a whole group of creatures. It's almost like the term reptile, but maybe a little bit more specific than even that. But dragon would have included flying dragons. It would have included land dragons. It would have included sea dragons. Now, when we think of dinosaurs were actually specific types of land reptiles that stood upright. You know, unlike crocodiles or Komodo dragons that kind of lay on their belly, they had to have one or two hip structures so that it raised their body up off the ground. So yet, all the dinosaurs technically could be called a dragon, but not all the dragons would necessarily fit under that description of dinosaur, because it was a very specific type of land-dwelling creature. So that just kind of gives us kind of an overview. But you're right. There are a lot of accounts of dragons that are just clearly fantastic, that are not actually accurate or true. I mean, we see more and more of that here the last 100 years as people have written stories. You know, think of Lord of the Rings, or you might think of, stuff like the Harry Potter series and things like that, you know, where people are talking about dragons, throwing this out there. Those are clearly myth, or How to Train Your Dragon, kids shows. But at the same time, dragon is also used in the New Testament metaphorically for Satan.
Right.
So it doesn't surprise me that there were some people saying, hey, let's describe Satan in this particular way, and it's clearly fantastic, not related to the animals. So that's why you have to be discerning when you look at these different accounts throughout history. Are they talking about a real creature, something living alongside other animals, or are they talking about, a figure of Satan, kind of an image?
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Bodie Hodge, who is the co-editor and compiler with Laura Welch of Dragons, Legends and Lore of Dinosaurs, illustrated by Bill Looney. It's from Master Books, a division of New Leaf Publishing Group. Bodie, do most people, when they hear the word dragon, think about these fantastical beasts? But let's talk a little bit more about the three times that the word that was translated from Hebrew. There are three words in Hebrew that become translated into English as dragon. One of them, behemoth, one of them is leviathan, the other one is tanyan. So what's the difference? Obviously, they're different creatures in the Bible because they have different names. What's the difference?
Well, if you actually look at it, leviathan and behemoth are a little more specific than tanyan. There's tanyan and tanim. There's actually a couple of variations of that particular word. And when you would translate that as dragon, that could be a sea dragon, it could be a flying dragon, it could be a land dragon. When we're talking about behemoth, it's definitely talking specifically about a land creature that had a tail that moved like a cedar. You know, this is a massive creature, the chief or the first of the ways of God. And God even said, when he's talking about that behemoth, he made him alongside Job. We see that in Job chapter 40, for example. So, I mean, that's that kind of creature. Now, leviathan was actually a water creature, so technically that one wouldn't be a dinosaur by any means. But if this is some sort of massive creature, spears can't penetrate it, nobody can throw darts through it, arrows just ricochet off of it. So it's clearly a unique creature. And that creature, even the Lord decided to break the heads of leviathan. We see that in Psalm 74, for example. But that's a sea creature. So we do have, based on the context in Scripture, we can understand these creatures a little bit more. But that word tanin, that's the one that's used most often and is most often translated as dragon. And we find it not just in one spot in the Bible. We find it all over throughout the Old Testament and the Scriptures.
Now, this particular book is a juvenile nonfiction title, but it's certainly is something that anybody can enjoy. This is the kind of book that if you're of a certain age, you read to your kids, or of another age, you read to your grandkids. It's very colorful. There are all sorts of nifty little creative things, little pockets. I'm looking at one page that has legends from around the globe, and it's got four pockets, Babylon, Greece, China, South America, United Kingdom, and America, that have little notes in them that you can take out and unfold, and they are fully illustrated as well. For example, in Babylon, Daniel and the Dragon. And this is talking about the tale of Bel and the Dragon, which is the extended book of the prophet Daniel in the Septuagint. It's mostly found in the Catholic Bibles under what we call the Apocrypha, this addition to the book of Daniel. Mm-hmm. And that's where tannin is used as a word there. So what made you decide to go with this? Is it something that small hands can open and have a story to share with their whoever's reading them the rest of the book? Or?
Well, you know, there's a lot of reasonings behind this. I mean, obviously the artwork is just beautiful.
Oh, yes.
And it's a very solid, very solidly built book. But yeah, with all the little flip tabs and the little open-ups, we wanted this to be a good family book. And that's usually the way we kind of pointed out, hey, whole families can get together going through this book, see the flip tabs, open up the little areas. Hey, where's the word dragon found in the Bible? Or, you know, what about Marco Polo commenting on, you know, some of these dragon dinosaur-like creatures, or John of Damascus, or Athanasius Kircher? You know, we see this throughout history. And we wanted it to be fun for the entire family. And I know this book, when it came out, it actually hit the top 200 children's books in America, which, you know, we were thrilled with that, even though we were shooting for a family book, but you can see where even children just eat this up. However, one of the things we wanted to do, we wanted to make sure that the content reached the adults as well. It's one thing to write a kid's book on dinosaurs and dragons and that sort of thing, but it's another to actually have real quotes here from some of these actual ancient people, these actual legends, so you can read the quote yourself. And, you know, that might be a little higher level than what some of the kids are used to, but that goes to show you how it works really well as a family book, too.
Well, for example, you have a quotation here from Cicero, the Roman philosopher and statesman, talking about the Egyptian ibis, a tall bird with stiff legs and a long horny beak, which destroys a great quantity of snakes, protecting Egypt from plague by killing and eating the flying serpents that are brought from the Libyan desert by the southwest wind, so preventing them from harming the natives by their bite while alive and their stench while undead. I love that. And there's here's Ammianus Marcellus, a 4th century Roman historian, talking about the ibis as well. Then there's something from the Tombstone Epitaph of Tombstone, Arizona. This is from April the 26th, 1890, about a strange winged monster discovered and killed in the desert. That's pretty fascinating stuff.
Yeah, in fact, that's probably one of the last dragon accounts that I was able to find, you know, of this creature. They actually sent samples of this off to different scientists and universities. And a host of the townspeople came out and saw, you know, they just published this like it was any other creature, a unique one that was shot and killed. Here's something interesting, though. You know, that word dragon, up to this point, a lot of people still entertain dragons as being real creatures. They didn't think too much about it. Like I said, in the 1800s, though, there were some people, some elite, going, hey, I think these things might be a myth because they're not seeing them anymore. But in 1902, the Encyclopedia Britannica actually has an entry for sea dragons. They were just rare by that point. What we saw, though, in 1910 in Nelson's Loose Leaf Encyclopedia, as well as Encyclopedia Britannica, that's the first time where we saw these big public announcements saying dragons are a myth. And the whole reason they said they were a myth is, well, someone said there were some dragons still living up in the Alps. That's a mountain range over in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So a guy went up there. He couldn't find them. So he said, therefore, they're myth. So I guess them finally going extinct just completely escaped people's minds at that point.
I think it's also important, and of course, this is something about Answers from Genesis and about master books that's so important, and that is, if you have a Christian worldview, if you believe the Bible is true, if you believe Genesis is true, then there are some problems with the idea of believing that dinosaurs lived millions and millions of years ago. And the biggest problem is, if dinosaurs lived millions and millions of years ago, and let's say the Earth is millions and millions of years old, the Genesis teaches that until sin came into the world, that nothing died, nothing physically died, that death was a part of sin corrupting the world, right?
That's exactly right.
And so if you had dinosaurs that lived millions and millions of years ago, they'd all have to still be alive when Adam and Eve were there.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been very complicated, I'm thinking.
It would have been. You know, this whole idea of millions and billions of years of death, pain, struggling, and suffering that the secular world appeals to, it actually comes from rock layers. You know, a lot of us are driving around the country or different parts of the world, and you see these cuts in the hill to make these roads, or you go up to places like the Grand Canyon, you see these rock layers, and these rock layers contain fossils of dead things. And so people look at that, and they just assume those rock layers are laid down slowly and gradually over millions and billions of years. But here's what they're missing. They're missing that the vast majority of those rock layers were actually made by the flood of Noah's day. And so the flood of Noah's day was an event that occurred after Adam and Eve sinned against God. So we expect to see death in the rock layers, and we expect to see suffering and animals eating other animals. But when people reject the flood of Noah's day and try to put all that millions of years in there, they tend to try to put it before Adam sinned. And all of a sudden, you have that big problem, called death before sin. Yeah. And we've had rock layers since the time of the flood, but you know, most of them are actually from the flood of Noah's day.
Now, that also brings up something else. One of the most important events of the last 50 years or so was the Mount St. Helens eruption, because it was a classic case of catastrophism. And I remember when it occurred and reading about things that were discovered after the mountain blew its top and rained fire and destruction,
yeah,
that it instantly turned trees into carbon and so forth. I mean, all the things that we had been told by people who believed in evolution, that it took billions and billions of years to create coal, it took all this time to create oil, it took all this time for all these layers to be laid down. And then we discovered after Mount St. Helens in 1980 that it didn't really take all that long. It just took a massive catastrophe in order to produce coal or in order to lay down layers like this.
Right. The key was the right conditions. It doesn't take millions of years to form coal or oil. You know, we can actually make coal in laboratories, you know, in just a few weeks. You can make oil from algae in less than 30 minutes. We can actually make fossils in less than 24 hours in a laboratory. So it doesn't require this millions of years. We've all been taught that, and we've been ingrained with it. It's been pushed onto us. But when you actually look at the science behind that, it doesn't require millions and billions of years for so many of those processes. Even things like petrified wood or gemstones. You know, when Mount St. Helens went off, you know, people were out there looking for gemstones because the heat and pressure actually forms gemstones in certain instances. So, you know, there's a lot to that. And I think that, you know, seeing Mount St. Helens blow and it went off in 1980. I think it went off again in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in Illinois. I remember the ash cloud flying over us. You know, it kind of looked like thick clouds. But, you know, it was amazing because it did show that what catastrophes can do quickly. And I think it was a great confirmation of what we read in the scriptures about the flood of Noah's day.
I have to say that because you mentioned him, I'm going to bring him up. The late Dr. Henry W. The late Dr. Henry M. Morris was one of the first scholars whose books I read that said, no, Genesis is true, and no, the world isn't billions of years old and so forth. These things are perfectly possible within a short Earth time frame if you are not looking to try to avoid the possibility of a supernatural creation by God. I think I heard it described as evolutionists say, if you give us enough time, something's bound to happen. And that's a pretty cavalier thing to be able to base all of the evidence, all of the information that they have disseminated for the last 200 years as fact, when everything that's been discovered since then doesn't support that at all.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I absolutely love reading Henry Morris myself. You know, I feel like I'm a third generation from him. You know, he and Dwayne Gish and Gary Parker, some of these guys were like the first wave of creationists saying, hey, let's get back to the Bible, especially about the flood.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see Henry's son, John Morris, you know, and Steve Austin and Ken Ham. You know, these guys were like the second wave of creationists that really took this out here, you know, and I feel like myself and Dr. Georgia Purdom and Dr. Jason Lyle, some of us, we're like the third wave, it feels like.
Yeah.
So we're actually riding on the coattails of people like Dr. Henry Morris, and it's pretty exciting.
Standing on the shoulders of giants, that's really what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What else about looking into dragons was particularly interesting? I know the book came out originally 11 years ago. This new version is just out and is just gorgeous and is part of this wonderful Master Books curriculum. Do we want to talk a little bit about the curriculum?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're more than happy to. You know, a lot of people, especially homeschoolers, you know, really dive into this material like it's going out of style. And that's because, you know, the world uses dinosaurs and dragons as, well, dinosaurs in particular as icons of evolution. A lot of times people see dinosaurs and it's almost associated hand in hand with an evolutionary worldview. And what we're showing in this curriculum is, hey, you know what, when you start with the Bible, it makes sense of dinosaurs. It makes sense of dragons. And, you know, if you just think about this, you know, dinosaurs, you know, being land animals, they would have been made on day six of creation. They would have been made the same day as man. If you think of, like, the flying dragons or the sea dragons, they would have made on day five, a day before Adam and Eve. So they would have been living at the same time. But you know what? We're in a culture that preaches at millions and billions of years. And so that's what curriculum like this is designed to do. It's designed to give those answers as kids go through this. And, you know, kids enjoy this. This is a great subject. It really is.
Well, and I will say that I have had the privilege of talking with your father-in-law a number of times, and there are some dinosaur books in here that of whom he is the mm-hmm. author, as well as lots of other wonderful books. And like you said, these are the guys that were kind of the second great wave of creationists that they're still producing scholarly works that show that the Bible is absolutely realistic, and to mm-hmm. pretend that it's not is to frankly be illogical.
That's exactly right. So
the idea of talking about dinosaurs and dragons, when you first started working on this book with Laura Welch, did you have people that were friends of yours who were not believers that said, geez, Bodie, what are you talking about? How could dragons be a serious thing to study?
Well, you know, I mean, you get a handful of detractors like that, but by and large, most people are rather supportive because they're kind of curious at the idea of how all this really works and how they really want to dive into and look at dinosaurs and dragons from a biblical viewpoint. You know, I mean, I did get a handful of people who are within the church, you know, who have bought into millions and billions of years, you know, and they sometimes struggle with this issue. You know, I did have a handful of people go, hold on a second, dragon, you know, that's associated with Satan. Maybe we shouldn't be doing this, you know, but at the same time, they're walking around with a T-shirt that has a lion on it, you know, and of course, Satan is likened, you know, as a roaring lion walking around. You know, so we have to be discerning about those kinds of things. You know, in this instance, of course, we're talking about the actual creature. You know, and, it was interesting, too, a lot of these ancient dragon legends, you know, some of these dragons were pretty vicious. And a lot of these dragon legends ended with a dragon getting killed. So, you know, if you think about how vicious these were and how they would attack people, you know what, I think that's a good analogy for Satan when it comes down to it.
Is there anything that you wanted to tell us about the book or about any of the curriculum that you've worked on from Master Books that I haven't asked you about?
Well, here's one thing I want people not to miss. When we talk about dinosaurs or we talk about the flood or, you know, we talk about Mount St. Helens or whatever it might be, yes, these are great subjects. This is wonderful material. But I don't want people to disconnect this from the truthfulness of Scripture. The reason we do these types of things, and this is called apologetics, which means to give a reasoned, logical defense for your faith. The reason we do this is we want people to go, oh, wow, the Bible is true. And because the Bible is true, the message of the gospel found in that same Bible is also true. So I don't want to disconnect dealing with dinosaurs and dragons. I don't want to disconnect that from the gospel of Jesus Christ. I want to use that as a springboard to make sure people know about the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, because ultimately that's what this is all about.
Well, it is a really gorgeous book, visually very arresting, very engaging, and I can see younger readers really enjoying going through this. This is not like sitting down with a little kiddie book and reading it that you're finished in 10 minutes and then you move on to something else. You can sit and explore these pages and all of these little add-ons and pop-outs and things like that and work your way through this book over a period of a week or so at least, depending on the age of the child, and find them absolutely fascinated by it. I think it's a great resource and a great way to counter the prevailing mythology of macular evolution.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? It's just a beautiful book. You know, I think the guys at Master Books did an excellent job. You know, working with Laura Welch, she's amazing. You know, she is a brilliant lady, and you know, she has an eye for these kinds of things. And you know, just working with her was wonderful. But yeah, the team there at Master Books, which is a division of New Leaf Press, they really are a wonderful group out there. So be praying for them.
How can people find out more about Master Books and more about the books that you have written, Bodie?
Well, if they were to hop on the Master Books website, you know, they're going to get a listing of all these different books and some of the outlets where they can find some of these resources. You know, I also work with Answers in Genesis, of course. My office is here at the Creation Museum, and I'm down at the Ark Encounter quite often. So people visit the Ark Encounter, the Creation Museum. There's tons of my books out here in the bookstore, or they can hop on the website, answersingenesis.org. And search for books from Bodie Hodge, and there's all sorts of books and videos and things like that.
Excellent.
That are, wonderful resources.
Now, that's up in, is that in Lexington, Kentucky?
Yeah, it's near there. Just north of Lexington is where the Ark Encounter is. It's probably closer to the Florence area, Cincinnati. I think Cincinnati. The Creation Museum is actually very close to the Cincinnati Northern Kentucky Airport. A lot of people don't realize the Cincinnati Airport's actually in Kentucky. But yeah, we're right by it. So.
Did not realize that.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Well, I have a sister who lives up there, and I've been wanting for a long time to go up and visit her and convince her to bring her grandchildren, and let's all go to the museums. So hopefully we'll be able to do that ere long. Well, Bodie, it's just a beautiful book and a great topic, and I'm really glad that we've had a chance to talk again. I've missed talking with you, so we'll just do this again more often, okay?
You bet. God bless you, Doc.
Okay. And you, my friend. Good to talk to you. Our thanks again to Bodie Hodge of Answers in Genesis. His most recent publication is Dragons, Legends and Lore of Dinosaurs, edited and compiled by Bodie Hodge and Laura Welch, with illustrations by Bill Looney, and it is published by Master Books, which is a division of New Leaf Publishing Group. You can also check out masterbooks.com. And there you can also find out about Master Books curriculum, Where Faith Grows. So thanks for joining us for the first Sunday of Advent next week, and for the next couple of weeks, we'll be talking about Advent and about Christmas. So until then, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. And I appreciate you being here on your favorite radio station and on my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, thanks for listening, and God bless.